Hello everyone, and welcome to Season 2 of the Rut Podcast. For those of you who are new to the Rut, we explore the extraordinary stories, psychology, and deep intricacies of men's mental health. I'm your host, James Roycroft Davis, and I started this podcast after finding myself in a rut, feeling like I was never going to come out. But I did eventually, because I started to talk about how I felt. Our mission is very, very simple. We want to finally get men talking. Talking about their issues. Talking about their problems. Talking about their mental health. There's still way too much stigma around men's mental health, so we want to break down toxic masculinity one podcast at a time. If we talk, we save lives. It's that simple. Remember to subscribe and leave us a review too. And you can find us on social media by searching at the Rut Pod for all the latest updates on episodes. This week, I have the pleasure of sitting down with somebody who I've admired for a very, very long time. As somebody who has always been passionate about politics, Alistair Campbell has been at the forefront of mainstream politics and British media for over 30 years now. He's edited national newspapers, he was director of communications under Tony Blair and was widely known as Tony Blair's right-hand man through the New Labour movement and government. He's been at the front and centre during some of the biggest moments in British political history. And he has battled mental illness for over 40 years. He's experienced psychotic breakdowns, clinical depression, anxiety, and overall an extraordinary fight against his own mind, really. He's one of the world's leading mental health campaigners, and I'm absolutely delighted to welcome Alistair to the Rut this week. So, without further ado, here's Alistair's story. So, please, leave all judgment at the door. Alistair, welcome to the Rut. How are you?
I'm okay.
You're okay?
I'm okay. Yeah.
Go on, expand.
Well, it's funny because I did a piece during lockdown for Tortoise where I interviewed lots of people. It was actually a thing the publisher of my book suggested to, because my book got delayed from May to September.
Yeah.
He said, and we'd announced it was going to be May, then it got delayed. So they said, can't you sort of do some videos online, just talking to people about their mental health in lockdown? So what I did was, I did all these interviews with people like Nicola Sturgeon, David Lammy, Josh Widdicombe, Maro Itoji, Jamie Carragher. I did some really good, interesting people. But my first question was always, how are you? It's a bit like you did now. And it was interesting how many of them said, I'm okay. And then if you, like I just did, but then if you probe okay.
Yes.
And so when I now, whatever I say now, I remember Josh Widdicombe said, he said, that thing about how are you, it's gone from being a sort of inconsequential piece of chit-chat, small talk, to actually a kind of meaningful existential question for everybody.
Absolutely.
So I would say at the moment, yeah, I'm pretty good. I'm okay. I'm not kind of up there, and I'm not down there.
There's two responses, though, aren't there? There's the I'm okay, and then there's I'm fine, which to me, often, when somebody says they're fine, I always used to say it. For me, always stood for I'm fucked up, insecure, neurotic, and emotional.
I certainly think okay has a better vibe than fine.
Yes.
No, it's fine. Can I help? No, I'm fine. Whereas, are you okay? Yeah, I'm okay. Whereas if you say, are you okay? They say, yeah, I'm fine. I agree with you on that. So I think okay is okay. Fine is not fine.
Very good. I want to talk quickly about that Tortoise piece because I want to just understand what you learned because you spoke to several people for that. You spoke to Jamie Carragher, Gary Lineker, and others across the board. And the results you got from those interviews really surprised you, right?
It did, because, you know, I know you're focusing on men, so if we just go through the men, I think I could say that almost without exception, they surprised me in terms of almost like to the opposite of what I thought they would be. So I know them all, you know, personally to greater and lesser degree. So for example, you know, if you think of Gary Lineker, super cool, chilled, incredibly kind of together sort of person in, you know, in his sort of public persona. And he was like, if you watch it, you can see them online on my website. It's like, he's doing this and he's kind of, you know, he's scratching and he admitted, he said he'd found it really, really, really hard. Now, he was then, I think it was interesting how, you know, I've got a dog. He just lost his dog. And I think that was kind of just a worst possible time for that to happen. But he was really, I felt he was kind of, he was still very Gary Lineker. He was, you know, charming and funny and all that. But I felt that he was struggling with it a lot more than I thought he would.
Yeah.
The one who, even more than that, was Jeff Stelling from Sky Sports. Now, Jeff Stelling is like, if you look at Jeff Stelling on a Saturday afternoon when he's presenting his program, he's Mr. Positive, he's Mr. Energy, he's Mr. Motivated. He's just a legend. He's brilliant at what he's one of the best broadcasters ever, I think, at what he does and the job that he's got, which is, if you think about it, remember when Soccer Saturday started, it's like, you know, this is basically a radio program. How are they going to make this a TV program? But they've done it brilliantly. And he, when I said to him, Jeff, how are you? He straight away, he didn't say okay, he didn't say fine. He basically said, I've been struggling. He said, I wake up and I don't want to get up. I don't feel any motivation. And he said, he's known kind of psychological distress before. But he sounded to me, as somebody who knows what depression is like, he sounded depressed. And then Jamie Carragher, who I thought would really, really struggle with lockdown, because the thing about Jamie Carragher, you know, I don't know how obsessed you are with football. I'm obsessed with football. He's on a different level. He's on a different level. And I thought, really? Jamie Carragher, without football, it's just not going to be a very, very good thing. And he said, you know what? I feel really bad about this, but I'm really enjoying it. I'm really enjoying lockdown. I'm enjoying being with the kids more. I'm enjoying going for long walks. And Josh Widdicombe said the same. He said that, you know, he'd once got into a rhythm. And then Mario Itoje, who, I mean, like, you know, the guy's a beast. He's like, you know, he's so physical. And you think, there's a guy who trains every day, big contact, you know, at it the whole time. And he was so chilled. He was like, you know, I've been... And he said an amazing thing, which I think would help a lot of your listeners. I thought it was a brilliant kind of insight. He said, you know what? He said, normally in life, you just... Everything's so fast. Everything's, you know, the next thing, the next thing. I've actually had the chance, he said, to sit down and have a conversation. He's now 25. And he said, I've been having this conversation in my head between Mario Itoje, age 25, and Mario Itoje, age 18. And I've been checking where I am. And I thought, you know, that is wise.
Mm.
So that was interesting. And the other guy, David Harewood, the actor, he was another one. He said that he was enjoying it. Although I spoke to him yesterday, and he's going back to work very soon. He's going back to Canada. He's filming something.
Right.
And he said he needs to be back. But he said, when I spoke to him, he said he was feeling guilty because he was like, he was fine. He was okay and fine. And so, but that was always interesting was how he said something very interesting. He said that this is the first time in our lifetime, possibly the first time in history, where every single person in the world has been having to some extent deal with the same problem.
Yes.
You know, even something as big as the Second World War, there were millions of people that weren't affected by it.
Mm.
Whereas this, every single government, every business, every school, every hospital, every organization has had to think about COVID-19. And he said what was interesting was that all of us are adapting to that differently. So I thought that was really interesting.
How did you enjoy lockdown?
Oh, up and down, to be honest. I wrote a piece. Oh no, it's not out yet, but I've written a piece for GQ about this. It was I hate saying roller coaster, but it was. What happened was I actually, because I'm asthmatic and also because of the depression, I've got a friend in Albania, who's the Prime Minister of Albania. I've worked with him for years on sort of strategic advice and stuff. And he was sending me messages about Italy, what was happening in Italy. And he was also sending me stuff. He was seeing these clips of Boris Johnson saying, you know, we'll deal with it and we'll be the country that stands up against it, all the bullshit that he came out with. And Eddie was sending me this stuff saying, this guy's got no idea how bad this is going to be. This is really, really, really dangerous. And Albania was already in lockdown. Mm. And he was sending me these pictures. He sent me this picture of a bus, and they'd stopped all but key workers going on buses, and they had policemen on buses with masks checking who was on the buses. So I was thinking, you know, this is serious. And I did Sport Relief up in Manchester. So it was March the 13th, and I went up there, and all day I thought, I was feeling, this is not right. So I was on this run. I remember doing this run with Sophie Raworth, and then I was on this travelator, and so I was doing it. I was engaging in the Sport Relief thing, but I'd say I got on the train, and I got back home, and I went into my own personal lockdown. So that was March 13th. And then for the first bit, I really enjoyed it. I wrote a long piece about how, you know, it was quite nice, for example, to discover that the person with whom I was going to be spending 24 hours a day, having been with her for 40 years, I still got quite like being with 24 hours a day. That's quite a bonus. I liked the fact that we had a decision to make about whether to postpone the book. That was difficult because I didn't want to, but in the end I was persuaded I should. Probably the right thing to do. And then I went into a kind of, can't even describe it. I started doing this Tree of the Day thing, which I've been doing for a while on social media. But I was really getting into nature and birds and all that stuff, and that was quite nice. And then so I got into that kind of quite mellow phase, and then not long after that I definitely became manic.
Really?
Yeah, if I go back, I've kept a copy of a link of every single thing that I wrote during this period. I mean, it was mad. I was writing two books as well, so I was working on two books. One day I did something like, I think it was 22 different articles for 22 different countries about COVID and about how useless our government was. I mean, it was kind of obviously a bit therapy for me.
Well, I was following you on social media, and it was, the level of posts you were posting were mad.
And you would only have seen a fraction of what I was actually doing, because other stuff I was doing was not on social media. And then I'll tell you the tipping point. A couple of tipping points came when I did this. And it's funny because Fiona's obviously been with me all these years. She knows when I'm getting a bit out of control. And she's quite good with it, but it's hard to deal with. And so she sort of humours me a bit. And then she sort of says, you know, shouldn't you calm down and what have you? And so I was in this mode. And two things happened. The first thing was, this is really interesting, my sister, who lives up in the Midlands, she phoned me up just having a chat. And we were chatting away. And then she said, by the way, are you okay? She obviously knows about all my kind of stuff. Are you okay? I said, yeah, I'm fine. No. She said, well, you know my friend Sue that you met when you came to talk at our book club? I said, yeah. She, you know the one who, you know, she describes? Yeah. She said, well, she phoned me the other day to ask if you're okay. Because she'd seen you on telly, and she said she was a bit worried about you. And I said, what's she talking about? What are you talking about? Of course I'm okay. What's she talking about? I knew in my own mind straight away the interview she meant. I knew, right, because I had been absolutely full pelter during the Dominic Cummings thing. And I said, well, you know, I'm fine. What's the problem? She said, well, the only thing is, you remember what she did for a living? I said, no. She said, well, she works at Rampton. You know, the secure psychiatric hospital. Mm. So she's a specialist in personality disorders. So she's looking at me thinking something's bad. So that sort of, you know, that lodged in there somewhere. And then the next day, Fiona and I were out walking the dog on the heath, Hampstead Heath, and I started doing this thing where I was singing national anthems, but I was adapting the lyrics of all the national anthems to stuff about Dominic Cummings. So, for example, the Russian national anthem was just dum 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 dum. I was doing these, I was recording them on the phone. Fiona was just sort of going along with this. I got back to, I did France, Germany, did all the sort of big national anthems. I got back to the house and I thought, I'll do the best, I'll do God Save the Queen. It was something like God Save Our Gracious Dom. It was Boris me being Boris Johnson, singing God Save Our Gracious Dom, Long Live My Noble Dom, Oh, I Love Dom, Send Him, anyway, blah, blah, blah. And then I thought, rather than just sing it like that, I'll dress up. So I put on a suit and I put on a shirt. And my brother, who was in the army, he was in the Scots Guards, I put on Donald's tie. So I put on Donald's Guards tie. And then I put on these medals as well. And I did this thing. And I got a really, lots of instant outcry, you know, blah, blah, blah. Johnny Mercer, the defence ministry, went off on one. He and I ended up having an absolute explosion. And then Fiona was downstairs kind of watching all this kick off, and she came up and said, listen, you know. And then a friend of mine, interesting this, right, a guy used to work for me in number 10 called Martin Sheehan, who I still see very regularly because he works at Portland where I, you know, I know
Portland, George Pascoe yeah. Watson, yeah.
Okay, yeah. So I'm on the advisory board there and do strategy with them. And Martin, who always, when we were at work and since, has always called me Gaffer, right? Just does. It's a football thing, as you know. And he phones me up and says, Gaffer, do us a favour. I said, what? He says, just turn your phone off. And I did. Because those three things had combined to make me realise. And then, of course, what happens when you've been like that? Then I went into a...
So what's it, tell me what it's like to be Alistair Campbell in a manic, depressive, would you call it episode?
That wasn't an episode so much as, that probably was an episode actually, in that, well, I'll tell you, it got bad enough. You see, the trouble is, when you're on the manic end, and I'm not manic, I've got friends who've got, you know, what used to be called manic depression, who are, you know, I've got one very close friend who, for example, when he's in a manic phase and he's on an airplane, he thinks he can fly the airplane. And he wants to fly the airplane and he'll want the pilot to get out of the way. You know, he's done that. He'll do things like, you know, he'll be, he doesn't quite do the kind of, I believe I'm Superman thing, but anything he thinks that he can do, he thinks he can do it. Now, I don't get like that, but what I do get is this kind of, another friend of mine once called demonic energy. I get an energy level that is just phenomenal, which is why I'm doing all that output and I'm not sleeping and all that. And the thing is that, you know, you've got to be careful because, when it goes too far, it's bad and it can be dangerous. But, you know, if you're in... Like I'd say, if I think back to politics, some of the best work I ever did when I was in that kind of just, you know, that phase of the just the energy that you have. And as long as you're channeling it, it's fine. So I would argue that, for example, when I was in that phase in lockdown, and a lot of the stuff I look back at, I was writing good, decent stuff. Some of it was a little wacky, but most of it was really, really good. Some of the advisory stuff that I do with some of these leaders in different parts of the world, I was writing really good stuff. And I won't say who it was, but one of them, you know, I wrote him this note in the middle of the night and he took it on board and I could see a change in like a week in some of the stuff that he was doing and saying. So that was, you know, so that then makes you feel, right, I'm on it, this is working. And then, so I think what then happens, probably about for me, for other people, it can go on for weeks, but for me, there's this kind of 24-hour period when I know back here, I'm not in control of myself. But I know, but here I'm thinking this is all going really well still, but I know it's coming to an end. And that was what happened on that day. And the thing with my brother was like the medals. And I think the fact, you know, sometimes I think these things are kind of not designed. I'm not doing a big God thing here because I don't do God, as you know, but my sister and my brother, with Fiona in the middle saying, you know, and then a friend, then somebody I trust, a colleague and a friend that I trust, when that sort of circle comes together and says, you know, but then what you do when you, because then what happens, you sort of go, oh, fuck, you know, here we go again, because you know that after the up there is coming the crash, and the crash was a really bad one. It was like, I mean, I've written in the book, one of the chapters is about this 1 to 10 system I have for my moods. And people think this is a bit odd, but for me, 1 is delirious and 10 is you kill yourself.
Yeah.
And I was touching 9. I was touching 9.
How does that feel?
It feels like that. It feels like you don't want to be here. You don't want to be here. You don't physically want to be here. You don't mentally want to be here. And then what happens with me, I've written a chapter in the book about suicide. I had a cousin who I was very close to who killed himself in 2000. And when I say close to, I was close to when we were children. You know, grew up together and all that. And even though he lived a very different life, he lived in the Hebrides, he grew up in the Hebrides, but we were similar characters and we both played the bagpipes and I think similar styles of people in a way, but of course leading very, very different lives. And I, when his mother died at the funeral, and his kids, I know his kids very, really well, they're all grown up now, but I had this amazing chat with his daughter because she was like, it's hard to describe this, but Tyree is this beautiful island, and where Lackey is buried, it's the most beautiful burial spot in the world. And he's got the corner slot looking over the beach into the sea. It's just amazing. And his grandmother was buried, and my grandmother as well, was buried in the same place. And we played the pipe, me and my Lackey's son, we played the bagpipes, this thing. And Lackey's daughter, Mary Lindsay, was just in buckets of tears all day. And obviously she loved her grandmother and that, but I talked to her later and it was about him, it was about her dad. And, you know, the conversation I've had with her and with the children is that if you are a survivor of suicide, then you wouldn't be human if you didn't think at some point, this must be partly about me. Mm. You know, why did he not love us enough that he wanted to stay? And what I've written about is actually really makes me angry when people say, when somebody kills themselves, you know, God, how selfish, don't they think about the people they leave behind? When I'm in that suicidal ideation state, that's all I think about. Mm. I'm thinking, and I persuade, well, I don't persuade myself because I've never done it and I don't think I ever will, but what happens is you end up persuading yourself. So, for example, I write about sometimes I won't be able to sleep. Fiona's lying there asleep. And you end up saying to yourself, God, look at her. She's completely happy because I'm not in her life at the moment. She's fast asleep. And then as soon as she wakes up, I'm going to be here. She's going to be thinking, oh, God, what's it going to be like today? And okay, so then you start to say, well, if I kill myself, she'll be really upset, especially if we do it now and she finds the body. Well, that's going to be bad and she's got to tell the kids and that'll be grim. But they'll get over it. You know, then you say, and this stuff, you go in this loop and then you say, I mean, look, you know, when I was a kid, couldn't imagine my parents being dead, right? Well, they're both dead. I've got through it. I'm here. I'm doing stuff. So my kids will be fine. You persuade yourself. Yep. And then before you know it, you're sitting there, and this has happened to me, you're sitting there with a pen and a notebook, and you're planning your funeral. That's what I do. And it's I can't describe it really, because at the moment, as I said to you, I'd say I'm probably on about, where am I today, about 5, 6? No, 3, 4. I'm kind of, I'm okay. And I've got quite a lot of work to do today. I'm going to go on a long bike ride this afternoon. I'm doing this German course at the moment. I'm listening to this German podcast. I really like. So I've got things in the day to look forward to. I'm fine. But when I'm at that kind of 7, 8, 9, it's horrible.
I want to talk about life in number 10, because there's I read your memoirs at uni for my dissertation, and there was particular parts in there where actually you're almost entirely miserable all the time. And you say it's because of the enormous pressure you put yourself under. What was the pressure you kind of felt in those situations? I totally appreciate that you are sat there next to Tony Blair, who has just won an election in 1997, comes across as country's answer to everybody's problems. He's got the backing from all the papers, including Mr. Murdoch. So it is a very, very big job, but you were miserable. And so there's an interesting, I suppose, dichotomy there where you're enjoying it and you're doing the job very, very well, but you're miserable. So where's the pressure there?
It's funny that, because it's true. When I first transcribed my diaries, I was at several points struck by just how miserable I seemed to be.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, how many days start, woke up feeling shit, went to bed feeling shit.
Didn't help though, being constantly peppered by my father.
Well, you know, the media is hard to deal with. Politicians are hard to deal with. It was difficult sometimes at home when, you know, the politics came into the house, and if Fiona and I disagreed about big stuff. And you know, I think as well that in a job like that, you can kid yourself that you're really being a devoted father, but it's very, very hard to give them the time, you know, the kind of commitment that they need and want and deserve. I think the pressure comes at you all the time. I think it's the sense of, you know, there's no, particularly today, there's no such thing as a day off, really.
No.
I mean, Boris Johnson seems to have quite a lot. I don't know how he does it, but. It's like, I remember once, funny enough, talking to you and both of Lord Beefy, and you know, we're talking about this thing about what pressure is, and you know, people talk a lot in top level sport about the pressure they're under. Of course, it's pressure. If you're a cricketer and you've got to take a wicket in the last over in a Test match to win the Ashes, say that's a form of pressure, but it's kind of in that moment. Whereas I think the difference at sort of, you know, the top level of politics and government, to extend the cricket analogy, it's like having, you know, the 50 best fast bowlers in the world coming at you every single day, and you don't know what angle they're going to be coming from. You don't know whether they're going to be bowling slow or fast, leg spin, off spin, you know, go for the head, go for the pads. It's just at you all the time. And I think when you say where the pressure comes from, if I think, for example, about weekends and holidays, interesting, when I was going through my diaries, how my holidays always seem to start with a kind of quite bad depression. And I think that's literally a decompression. You're saying to yourself, you're building up, you're saying, right, we're going on holiday. I'll be able to spend some time with the kids. I'll be able to be a proper human being again. And then you get on holiday and you can't.
No.
Because the fastballs are still coming. And if you're like me, and you are a bit of a control freak, and you may be, I am a good delegator, I can delegate, but once I've delegated, I need to be kept informed as to that the delegation is working. So I would find, you know, if I think of all the holidays that we had that were completely ruined by, yeah, Omar bombing was one, Robin Cook, you know, and part of this was being a victim of my own success, close quotes. You know, Robin Cook, when he's you know, he's about his marriage and it's very personal and all that stuff. And contrary to some of the mythology, Robin and I actually had a very good relationship, and Robin only wanted me to deal with it. And he actually sort of said to me, look, I know you're on holiday, but I'd really appreciate it if you could kind of grip this for me. And now when somebody says that to me, my instinct is to do it. And likewise, Tony Blair, who, you know, I mean, I like Tony a lot. I like him as much now as I did when I started working with, probably more, if not more, yeah. And not a lot of people can say that about their bosses. I don't think many Murdoch's people do. No. And so he, but even though Tony was a great boss at many levels, he was also somebody who could phone me up and regularly did, say I was on holiday and phone up and it'd be like, just having a chat. How you doing? What are you up to? Having a nice time? Have Bernie bought anybody yet? All that sort of stuff. And they say, by the way, just thinking, you know, just thinking ahead to the conference, just wondering if you've started to think about the speech. And I know where it's going. He's saying, you know, so I'll spend the next weekend writing and drafting a speech. And so that's pressure. But I think if I had to boil it down, the worst bits were when the workload was phenomenal, which it always was, but the workload was especially difficult and it was creating problems in my personal life as well.
Yeah.
That's when it became really difficult.
You're, by anybody's standards, a high achiever. Why is there such a high correlation between high achievers and depression, do you think?
I don't know. I mean, but I think you're right that there is. you know, there's the old cliche about, you know, dividing line between genius and being mad and all that stuff. I don't quite buy that. In fact, the only time I ever publicly upbraided Tony Blair was when he wrote in his memoir, he wrote about me and he said, I always knew he'd be a tough guy and good at strategy, but what I got was a genius, okay? That's nice. Nice for him to say that. And he said, you know, and I knew about his kind of mental health history. And he said, in my experience, there's two kinds of mad people. There's people who are just mad and they're dangerous. And there's people whose madness gives them a real creativity and edge. And I wrote a blog. I said, Tony, you cannot say that. That is so stereotyping. And it's not true. But what is true is that if you go down through history, when I wrote a book about winners, I wrote a book about the winning mindset, and I pointed out that, yep, you know, if you think of Britain's most famous and most revered prime minister, Churchill, Black Dog, Abraham Lincoln, greatest American president in history in the eyes of most, apart from Donald Trump, and he was a depressive as well. Florence Nightingale, Marie Curie. You know, you go through them all, some of the great achieved, Charles Darwin, some of the greatest writers, some of the greatest musicians. Now, what I wonder is actually if it's not necessarily that you say a lot of high achievers have these kind of mental health issues, I think it's that we all do. And that when the people become amazingly high-profile people like a Churchill or a Lincoln and they're written about in history, everything comes out about them. Mm. And you discover they had, you know, mental health problems you probably didn't know at the time. I also think that a friend of mine in America, a guy called Nasser Gaymi, he's a psychiatrist, and he wrote a book about Martin Luther King, mental health. And now, I don't know if you know this, but Martin Luther King was, you know, would today be called manic depressive.
Didn't
And Nasser's theory was that what made him such an exceptional leader at that time of that movement was the fact that, if you like, his mania gave him the energy and the charisma and the belief in himself and the drive and the just going to keep going, and which a lot of leadership, that's what it's about, and the depression gave him that kind of understanding of the pain in the human soul. That's sort of very, you know, it's a 300-page book, but that's the sort of basic theory. And I think there's something in that. I feel, I remember once somebody wrote a profile of me, and it said, Alistair Campbell has had a successful career despite a history of mental illness. Okay? And I bumped into him at a conference a few weeks later, and I said, listen, it was a perfectly nice piece, but I reckon you could have written, and maybe should have written, has had a successful career partly because of. Because I believe that. I believe that. Mm. I believe a lot of the things that you might associate with me, based either on your outside perception or talking to your dad or whatever, you know, you'd probably, if I give you a few words, I think you'd probably say about me that I'm resilient, keep going. Well, I think that comes from having got through stuff, personal nature. Know my own mind. Well, that comes from knowing your own mind.
You've explored it long enough now.
Exactly, exactly. But that's helped me. That's helped me. Knowing my own mind has helped me. And then I think the creativity, as I said earlier, I think that the creativity I have comes from any pain. I don't think it comes from being happy. Yeah. And the thing, to go back to your point about the diaries, when the first book came out and did this event, I can't remember who it was with now, but somebody said, yeah, I've read your book and, you know, God, you were a miserable bastard. Something like that. And I said, it's true. That is true that a lot of the time I was there, I seemed to be very sad and sometimes very depressed. But all I can tell you, looking back on it, is I'm very, very, very happy that I did it.
Mm.
And that to me is what happiness is. That happiness is not about, did you have a good time and did you get pissed and fall over? It's not even about going out and having a nice meal with your mates and seeing a great film. It's not even about Burnley getting into Europe. That gives you happy moments, right? Happiness for me is looking back at all that and thinking, do you know what? I've had a lot of shit. I've had a lot of downs and the ups, but it's been amazing. Been amazing. And I feel I've achieved something, and I've got family, and I've got proper friendships, and I've got things that mean a lot to me. And the book, actually, the Living Better book, the one that I've just published about depression, the conclusion of it really is about me bringing together all the things that help me kind of stay most of the time on a pretty good keel. And they're a mix of stuff that everybody can do, like diet and exercise and sleep well if you can. But then there's the very personal stuff, you know, Burnley, bagpipes, languages, cycling, keeping fit. And you know, I've written, it's been really funny with the COVID thing because, I mean, I'm very privileged as a Burnley fan because, you know, I know the managers, I know the players, I get to know them, I have relationships with them, I can talk to them. But ultimately, my love of Burnley, I've realised this since the COVID, when we had that period when you couldn't go to the games, you could only watch on the telly, is that it's not about football for me. I've watched the Champions League games, but apart from Burnley games, I was hardly watching any Premier League football. Because in the end, it wasn't just about football. I do love watching football, good football. But actually, for me, the Burnley thing is about, it's about community and it's about friendship and it's about shared experience.
In the BBC documentary you did, Alistair Campbell, Depression and Me, there's one moment towards the end where you're filmed at Burnley, right? Mm-hmm. And you say, when I'm there, I'm in the moment. And that's where I'm often at my happiest.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for me, that kind of indicates you're kind of in this present state where all else in your mind, you move out of your mind and you move into this present being of Alistair Campbell. Doesn't matter who else, whoever the fuck is around me. I could be on commentary, I could be watching Burnley versus Liverpool, but still, I'm in that moment.
Mm.
Now, for me, when I've explored depression, anxiety with loads of people now through this podcast and just talking, it has been about understanding how to transition away from being in the past and the future and working out a way to bring myself back into the kind of present moment. Also kind of understood from the documentary that you were looking at antidepressants and ways in which you can, other treatments for depression. Do you ever look at like mindfulness, the art of being in the present, as described with Burnley, as a kind of cure? I'm just wondering whether you use that to kind of get out of the ruts you're in.
I have looked at all that, and I've tried all that, and I think it has been helpful at times. But at the moment, I think I said this in the film, and I say it in the book, because the book actually is based on the film, and I did it the wrong way around. Like most people sort of write a book and then make a film. I made the film and then I wrote the book. And I say there that I'd be very, very worried about coming off my antidepressants.
You did, yeah.
Now, they're part of... So what I see in my antidepressants as being... I don't say to people, I take antidepressants and that stops me getting depressed, or it helps me to deal with it. I don't say that. I say, I've worked out loads of different ways that I can help myself to either stave off depression or alleviate it when it comes. And listen, I've got to be honest, there have been times when I've been at Burnley when I've not been able to do that in the moment thing. When I've been watching a game and my mind's somewhere completely different and I'm just not there. But it's rare, and usually it can get me out of it. And I think it is that thing about football. Do you know what's really interesting? You mentioned the thing about 1997, I wasn't happy the night we won the election. And I think with me, it's because apart from football, I don't like those moments where everybody's meant to feel the same.
Yeah.
I don't really like weddings. I don't really like parties. I don't like events where... I don't really like Christmas much. I don't really like New Year. You know where there's a sort of expectation you've got to be happy.
Absolutely.
Right? Now, football, and particularly when the ball goes in the back of the net, right? That's the one time I will completely let myself rip. I never did that thing as a kid of going to... If I went to a rock concert, they're all doing the bloody thing with the mobile phone, or they're all going fucking crazy and all that. I'd be looking at them, not the band. I'd be thinking, what is wrong with you? Just listen to what these guys are doing. Stop thinking it. But football, that is what I do. But I think the in-the-moment thing... funny enough, the other day I was talking about cycling. I went out for a really long ride the other day when we were in France. And I said, I'm going to do that a couple of hours. But an hour and a half in, I got the... Sometimes you just get the feel, I'm going to keep going. I ended up doing about 4.5 hours, 5 hours. And there's this hill called Col Day. It's quite a tough little climb. And then it's got this really long descent into a place called Saint-Gel. And the climb was really tough. And it was incredibly hot. And I was struggling. I got to the top and drenched in sweat. And I sort of covered myself in water. And as I came down the climb, sort of freewheeling, I literally had this moment. And I just said to myself, gosh, you are so lucky. You are so lucky in your life.
And what made you think that, do you think? Or what made you experience that?
I've no idea. I think, because sometimes I can go out on the bike and I can just think, oh God, my legs hurt all the time. I don't know. I just don't know. I think whether it was a combination of...
Fascinating.
Stuff just comes together. On the way up the hill, I've been listening to this German podcast about the future of cinema, don't ask me why. I don't know what else I was thinking about, but it just came upon me as I was going down the hill, and I literally said the words to myself, you know, God, you are so lucky to have the life you've got. I just feel this freedom. I think it was that sense of freedom, actually. And the other thing, which is about being in the moment, I've always loved beautiful scenery, but I now love it in a kind of, you know, I can get... When we were on holiday in France, there was this little bird used to come into where we were every morning at the same time and just kind of peck around and then walk and then... And I kept trying to film it and get nearer and nearer and nearer. And as soon as he got within about 10 yards, it was away. So things like that, you just get these. And my sister, who's very religious, she would say those are kind of deeply spiritual feelings, and that if you go with them rather than kind of block them, you'll end up doing what she does, which is, you know, believe in a very, very, you know, passionate way.
Mm.
Now, I can't do that. But that's the power of that feeling. It feels like, I imagine it feels when you kind of, you know, see the light.
Mm. You mentioned earlier where somebody who wrote a blog about you said, despite mental illness. And something that I've been quite interested in is how people develop these belief systems about them when they use language to categorize themselves. So they say, I'm depressed. Basically, that's what they take on. You've obviously come out and said you're clinically depressed and or manically depressed. Do you think that's a box that categorizes you? Do you think that's something that is a help to you to understand the illness or how you feel?
No, and if you were to say to me what's your kind of relationship with mental health, I would say, this is a campaigner.
Okay.
So if I was, and like for example, there's not much sort of public speaking going on at the moment. But if I'm out on the public speaking circuit, it's always funny when you get introduced. And sometimes they just literally read the first paragraph of my website, or they read the first three paragraphs on Wikipedia, right? Other times they make an effort, okay, and they kind of, you know, and the things that almost always get said about me, number one is best known as his work with Tony Blair. Number two probably is Burnley.
Really?
Yeah. Then they always will say passionate football fan, Burnley. Maybe number two, mental health. And then Burnley bagpipes usually get a mention.
That's quite nice.
Yeah. So, and that's not a bad thing, actually, because in a way, whether I, you know, the thing with Tony Blair is what defines me professionally in a way. I mean, if I drop dead now, the obituaries would have Tony Blair's name in the intro.
Absolutely. How does that feel?
Fine. Absolutely fine.
Mm.
I guess if I invented a vaccine for COVID-19, I'd be known for that, but that's not going to happen. Unless I did something on that scale, then that's that. I'm fine about that. But I think the other things that they would then say, I remember, it's funny how things stick in your head sometimes. Remember when I stepped down at number 10 in 2003, and it was sort of, you know, big on the news all day long, and everybody on there, blah, 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 blah. Eventually got home, and my two sons had been watching the news all day. And I said, who's been on? And they said, oh, he was on, said this, and he was on, said that. And he said, the guy, Rory, my son, my eldest boy, said, I'll tell you who's interesting, it was Anne Rickham. I said, well, she basically said she hated you. And thought you were a terrible sort of influence on the world. But she said she thinks eventually you'll be best known for your work in mental health.
Wow, that's quite a compliment coming from Anne.
And bizarrely, Edwina Curry then said the same on the radio.
Blimey.
I was the next day, Callum and my other son, we drove up to Burnley. And actually, that was amazingly, that day, there's a picture of me with my son on our kitchen wall from the day, and it's the day after I've quit. I'm at Burnley, and it's amazing. I look completely chilled.
The day after you've quit, where?
Number 10.
03.
Yeah.
And I'm chilled, but in the documentary, it's there was a period after that where it was like
really bad. Yeah, no,
was that, was that a loss of purpose?
Yeah. So that in the immediate aftermath, you've got a purpose.
Yeah, you do.
You're just dealing with it. Yeah, I lost purpose definitely, and that became a real problem. And then also the other thing that happened, talk about pressure, the pressures that were then happening on me were, even though I'd left, Tony was phoning 5 times a day initially, and then it would go down, and then it was sort of like, can you come and have a chat? And then once the kind of transition to Gordon started to happen, I was by then about the only person that both of them were still talking to in a meaningful way. So I sort of had to deal with that. And actually, I remember I had this, I've written about this in the book. I had this session seeing my psychiatrist where I was really, really low. And I said, so he said, do you realize? He said, we do seem to spend more time here talking about Tony and Gordon than we do talking about you. He said, I wonder if it's worth you bringing them along one day and I could maybe try and sort them out. I said, I don't think that's going to happen. But yeah, that was a very, 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 very hard period.
When you're in that place, like we discussed it really at the start of the podcast, incredibly low. Honestly, life is just not worth living, or seemingly so. It's actually quite a primal place to be, having been there myself. It's like
you get there often?
Used to. At the moment, not for a couple of months, maybe two months. There's been an interesting transition with me, which has been depression for about 8 months. Earlier this year it was being suicidal and waking up every single day and thinking, fuck this, I need to jump off a bridge or stand in front of the district line at Edgware Road, to anxiety. And that's quite common, I've found, in people.
Oh, yeah.
Switching in between modes. But when you're down in that place, you're in complete survival mode. It's like primal instincts taking over. It's just constant living in like fight or flight. How does that affect your relationship with your wife and your kids?
It's a kind of moving thing, that one. I mean, I'd say that if I track back, so like, Sophia and I met 40 years ago, and I'd say in the early years, the demonic energy was there a lot.
Mm.
And I think the depressions were less visible because I was drinking so much.
Yeah.
So I think alcohol became a substitute. Then I think work became a substitute.
Mm.
But I never really opened up about it. But I think one of the big turning points for me was actually, I can't even remember when it was, but I remember waking up one day, having that feeling that you just described. And for the first time, just saying, if you're in a really bad depression coming on, and feel it coming on. And that was the beginning of this kind of more open approach.
Mm.
And I don't know if you found, since you started doing the podcast, whether it's helped you.
Beyond measure.
Yeah. So I feel, for example, when people sometimes say, I'm sure you get the same thing, when people say, I'm so brave the way you talk about this. And I say, well, why? I'm proud of it. Two, I feel it's such an important part of who and what I am. So to say it's brave suggests that that brave to me is stigmatizing.
Mm.
You know, I don't think it's brave. I feel it's just, it's what it is.
Normal.
But I think the openness has definitely helped. And I remember after that period, after I left number 10, and it's funny how Burnley always weaves in and out of this, I had this incident, which I described in the film and I've written about in detail in the book, where Fiona and I were at Hampstead Heath and I started beating myself up. Literally smashing myself in the face. And that was the point at which it was a bit like the medals thing. It was like, you've got to get help. This is not good.
Are those That's triggers? Those are kind of those triggers. Is that where you see it taking over? It's almost like self-loathing, isn't it? And
I think it was just raging frustration with myself that I couldn't get to feel better.
Mm.
And so then that's when I started to see this guy, David, regularly. And then once that happened, I thought, well, do you know what? The kids have seen, they've seen me when I'm lying on the sofa, monosyllabic. They've seen me when I'm, you know, writing 11 books in a day. And they've seen me lots in between. But I think what you've got to be careful with kids is that there's inevitably, I said the thing about suicide, there's inevitably, if they see that one of their parents being miserable or being difficult, there's inevitably part of them going to think, oh, it's because of me.
Mm.
So I sat them all down one by one and said to them, listen, just someone would say, it's not a big deal, but, you know, people might find out and they might get in the papers, I don't know, but just so you know, I'm seeing a psychiatrist, I'm going to be seeing him regularly, probably for quite a long time, and they're all fine about it. They all handled it very, very differently.
Really?
My daughter's always very in my face about it. What's wrong? What can we do? When, you know, she just bombards me with questions. The boys are much more kind of, do you want to go to a game? or, you know, it'd be much more a sense of, you know, they've seen it and all of my kids in their own way. I mean, Grace, my daughter's, she went to university in Paris and she had to leave because of anxiety.
Really?
Callum, our middle boy, he's got, he's alcoholic, recovering alcoholic.
Mm.
7 years without a drink, thank God. But I've always felt with them, openness is the best thing.
Yes, absolutely.
So what I do now is I'll say, and they'll react very differently. So I'll say, I might say to Rory, my oldest boy, I might say, oh, I've just had a few shit days. And he'll just sort of say, you know, do you want to go for a cup of tea or, you know, whatever. Callum, the same, be very practical. And Grace will be like, you know, just very on it all the time.
Solutions focused?
No, we're kind of just monitoring it, and so we're all very kind of sensitive to it. And then I think Fiona's worked out her own modus operandi for it, which is like, you know, because I don't know how you feel with the people that you're close to, but I find when I'm really down there, I want Fiona to be near, but I don't want her in my face.
Absolutely the same.
I don't want her asking, how are you feeling? I don't want her asking, you know, I don't mind her sort of saying, do you want to go for a walk? As long as if I say no, she just then goes away.
It's funny, I did a podcast, I did an episode with my other half talking about my battles and what it felt like from her perspective to go through the last year, essentially.
Well, Fiona's written a chapter in the book about living with my depression.
Right, okay. I want to get onto the book in a sec, by the way. I know we're coming up to the hour as promised, but... But, yeah, I found it funny because Abby, my other half, was saying, there's points, James, where I just wish that for one fucking day, we didn't have to talk about your mental health. What about me? I mean, I kind of put things into perspective for me. The burden.
Oh, yeah, well, you should take that.
Mm.
You should take that. You should really go with that. You've got to find a better description than the other half as well.
Girlfriend, partner, better half.
I think partner.
Partner.
Other half, very kind of... Yeah, not even another half.
Partner, then. We'll run with that, partner.
Right, so I think today, as soon as you finish this podcast, you should Is she with you now? Is she at work or what?
No, she's still in bed, actually.
Okay, well, as soon as we finish this, you go and say, how are you feeling today?
Very good. I will do. I will do.
I'd say, let's have a day where we're not going to talk about me.
I know. But you do get into that when you're in that world. I don't know about you. When you're in that world, it's a very selfish world, number one. There's nothing else that matters. From my perspective, anyway, there really is nothing else that matters apart from me working out a way, wallowing in my own self-pity and self-pity.
I do the wallowing and the self-pity bit, but a lot of it is about beating myself up about the impact that it's having on them, the inability to stop it for them, as it were. That does... So I wouldn't describe it as selfish in that extent. It's self-centered in that it's all about you. Mm. But I think one of the reasons I feel it so badly is because I'm thinking this is affecting them as well. Mm. And the thing that Fiona always says, I've always had, to an extent that I'm really not aware of it really, I've always had an ability to allow my moods to kind of fill a room, whether good or bad.
Mm.
In the film, you might remember the bit at the end where I talk about this dinner we were having.
Going to come on to that, yeah.
Yeah, and
because I experienced that recently, actually.
Did you?
I was on holiday in the south of France and with 12 friends, and several evenings I just felt that I could not get into any of the conversations that were going on around me, and I just went into my own mind, and it was this place where I was like, I don't really want to be here anymore. I'm very conscious of what people are thinking, actually, whether they're noticing me being quite withdrawn. And so actually all I want to do is go to bed. Now, I perceive myself to be a bit of an extrovert, but actually what lockdown and depression really and mental health has taught me is I'm a very introverted extrovert. I'm 50-50. And that balance, which can really quite quickly tip you over the edge in social situations, I'm becoming more and more surprised by. I'm having to sit there with Abby and being like, gosh, I really don't want to be here at the moment. Not in the sense I want to kill myself, but in the sense that I'm in a place where I don't entirely feel comfortable. And before that, I would have kind of let it go.
But I think that feeling of I don't want to be here is a thread not very far to the existential don't want to be here.
Interesting. Why?
That's what I feel. Whenever I get that feeling, I think, oh, this is a dangerous sign. But I think you've got to deal with it. You know, I think one of the things about friendship as well is like being able to be with people and say, you see, I can't remember if I've written about this in the book, but I wrote about my diaries. An amazing moment. After the documentary, you go back to the sort of great things happening because of, rather than despite. After the documentary went out, I got this email out of the blue, which I thought was a spoof at first, because it said, it's Eric Clapton here, saw your film, love to meet up.
Genius.
Chat about it. Anyway, which was amazing on all sorts of levels. One, because he's, you know, Eric Clapton is one of the most amazing musicians, blah, blah, blah.
Of course.
But also, I don't know if you remember this from my diaries, but the one time when I got really quite close to 10 doing it was at an Eric Clapton concert where friends had got some tickets and Fiona said, you know, we're going out to this Eric Clapton concert tonight. And I said, I really don't want to go. I don't want to go out. I don't want to get up. I don't want to go out. Please don't make me. And it was like, you know how it works. A little bit disappointed. Oh, this. Oh, that. Oh, that's going to, oh, fuck it. Stop the grief. I'll go. And we got there, rocking the gods. I ended up having to go for a walk to stop this urge to just dive over. And it was I told Eric Clapton this story. I said, it's fucking amazing to meet you like this, because you know, you phoned me about a film about depression. And do you know what's interesting? When we were making the film, we'd spent a whole day in the Albert Hall filming me talking about that, and it never made the cut.
Really?
Yeah.
Fantastic. And let's talk about your new book. When does it come out?
September the 3rd.
I'm hoping you'll post me a signed copy if possible.
Well, only if you tell all of your listeners to immediately go out and buy it.
Well, absolutely. Well, this is what we're about to talk about now. Living Better. How you survived depression.
Yeah.
I obviously haven't read it because it hasn't come out yet. What's it about and why? Obviously, it was a kind of post the film, and I imagine that film was so interesting to actually film because you got a great understanding of how a glass jar can change your life.
Yeah,
amazing. Now, I'm actually going to try it myself after this. It's incredible.
You should.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the kind of climax of the book, really. But, no, I don't know. I've written 16 books now, and I never quite know where... Obviously, the diaries are obvious, but I don't know where the idea is, why you suddenly say, I'm going to do a book. But I think part of the thinking was that I did quite enjoy making the film. I'm not a massive telly fan. I think television's obviously an amazing medium. But I think the thing, the reason why, for example, podcasts have taken off to the extent that they have, television is, particularly if you like curated television, it can be very constricting. So, for example, you know, I'm not saying the Eric Clapton story is, you know, any more than what I've said it is, but we spent half a day on that, didn't make the film. We did a whole long thing with my psychiatrist. That's quite a big thing for this guy. He's like, you know, he's older than I am. He's been around a long time. He's managed to do his work without having much of a public profile. He doesn't really want one. I persuaded him to do a thing in the film. Made about 5 seconds. So I think part of the thinking was there's all this amazing stuff that we did and these amazing people we talked to. So that was part of the thing. And then I went out more broadly. But the one, as you say, that did make the film and has made the book as well is the woman in Canada, Janine, who just gave me this very simple way of thinking about depression.
That was an extraordinary way, actually. For anybody,
let's not talk about that too much, James. Let's just let the listener understand they have to go and get the book to really get the full flavour of the jam jar and its importance in our lives.
Excellent. Fine. Okay. Well, let's move on to the core parts of the book to give to whet the listener's appetite. What are the core parts of that book? It's a motive title, isn't it? How I Survived Depression.
Yeah. The original title was Better to Live. And because I've maybe got a little bit more empathy and sensitivity than Matt Hancock and Boris Johnson, I just thought Better to Live doesn't fit well with tens of thousands of people dying of COVID. So I changed it to Living Better. I guess it's in two, it's a mix. It's partly is me and my depression, what the film was about. And then it's really just a kind of exploration of all these other things that people are doing. A lot of the scientists, researchers, and then it kind of comes together at the end with me through this jam jar theory. I don't like the title self-help, but because it's, you know, I think we're all individual. I don't think I can say to you, this is what you should do. But I think I can say, this is what I have done. And I think this is how, and then you can dip into that and think, well, okay, well, I'm not going to put Burnley in my jam jar, but I might put, I don't know who you support, but, you know, or whether you might be
Liverpool and but more of a rugby fan and Wasps.
Okay, well, her basic theory was that you can't control where you're from. There's nothing you can do to change your genes. There's nothing you can actually do to undo the experiences you've had. You can reflect on them, you can think on them. And she thinks we spend so much time trying to undo what's in the jam jar of life, as it were, that we miss the opportunity to think about how you kind of just grow the jam jar so there's more space for you to live your life. And when we talked about that moment of me coming down that hill, I think that's kind of what was in my head at the time, was thinking, God, I've got a fucking big jam jar. I've got, you know, good family, interesting work, reasonably, you know, pretty good health, financials, you know, nobody's got total financial security, but, you know, we're doing okay. And I've got these other things, you know, I'm sleeping well, I'm exercising every day, I've got new stuff coming up, I've got my football, I've got my music, I've got my books, I've got my creativity. And then what's interesting about when you get into that mindset, so this woman, Janine, who gave me this kind of theory, she was in Canada, and that's where I met her. And if you'd have been sitting next to me on the plane going to Canada, and you just said to me, you've got depression, haven't you? And I said, yeah, I'll get depression. You go, oh, that's interesting. And you just said, how do you deal with it? I'd probably have said, well, sertraline every day. I'd probably have gone straight to the kind of medication, right? Mm. And then I might have said, I see a shrink when I'm bad. Now, I'd say, well, yeah, I do deal with it pretty well. Still get it. Still have it bad. Had it bad recently, but much better place. And then I'll go through all the things.
Look, and it's funny. Life is just about, well, with mental illness, it's all about finding the different coping mechanisms as you progress in life to keep yourself at that equilibrium.
Yeah. Mm. So that's what I do. And then, you know, I talk about a lot of the first part is about grief. Mm. So my cousin, who killed himself, I've definitely had more than my fair share of very close friends who died young.
Yeah.
my parents, two brothers have died. Mm. One brother had schizophrenia, which is my that was when I really started to get into the whole mental health agenda.
Yeah.
I was still a teenager. He was in the army. So a lot of it's about that. It's about, you know, my own depressions, where I think they come from, what it's like. I really try hard to describe what it's like. And I really try hard to give a sense of what these different stages of my 1 to 10 are like. Mm. And as you saw when you asked me about what it's like, it's hard when you're not in it to describe it. I remember when I wrote the first novel, All in the Mind, and I had this psychotic episode. Well, I've not been psychotic for decades, right? But I've had a psychotic episode. I could remember that to write about it more vividly than I can remember a depressive episode.
Is that because of the level of trauma?
No, I think it's because of the level of feeling.
I mean, right.
So when your body is literally smashing itself apart, you feel it so much.
Yeah.
When I got arrested because I was behaving strangely in a public place. Mm. And what they meant by that was that I was actually in a public building and I was going like this. And the reason I was doing that is because I thought the insides of my head were exploding. And I couldn't understand why I wasn't bleeding.
It's extraordinary.
There was film and there was music and there was all this stuff going on. And so I think you can remember that because that is such a kind of intense feeling, whereas depression, as you know, is just you're lying on a sofa wanting to not be there.
Mm. Now, I've got five questions in a quick fire round.
Go on then.
But I just want to ask one last question, actually, before we move into that. I'm conscious of time, Alistair.
I'm not looking at the clock, I'm looking at my battery.
Okay, good. and this is, this question can kind of be taken in any which way, actually. But who do you think you'd be without depression?
Do you mean what sort of person, or do you want to name somebody?
No. What sort of person?
I think it'd be more boring. think I'd be less productive. I think I'd be less fulfilled.
Really?
Mm.
Why do you say that about being less fulfilled?
Because I think it gives me so much.
Wow.
Mm. I think the energy and the creativity comes from the kind of the positive feelings you get when you come out of it.
Mm.
You know, that episode recently was a really, really bad one. And I remember the book arrived, you know, the printed copy arrived while I was in the middle of it. I'll look at it, Living Better, How I Learned to Survive Depression. Fuck that.
Mm.
I haven't done it. But actually, I have. I have. It means and what it means is I've accepted I'm going to get depressed from time to time. I've accepted I'm going to get up there from time to time. And it's fine. I have learned to live with that.
You also accept that it will pass.
In the moment, you don't necessarily accept that, but your rational mind knows that it will. And actually, that's the other thing that's happened with the family and friends, is that it used to be when Fiona would say something like, "Oh, yeah, at least you know it will go away," that used to really irritate me. Whereas now, I get a bit of strength from that. Mm. I think it's not like Stephen Fry said that thing, who's quoted on the front cover, saying this book could save your life, by the way. But I remember him being asked once, if you had a red button there, and if you press that red button, you would no longer have bipolar disorder. Would you press it? And he thought long and hard and said no.
Fascinating. Mm. Let's move into these questions. What's your favourite book and why, number one?
Madame Bovary by Gustave Flaubert, because it made me fall in love with the French language.
Very interesting. You studied modern languages at Cambridge. Did you read it before that, or whilst you were there, or after it? First read it, I imagine you've read it a few times now.
I think I first read it for A-level.
Right, okay.
I think, yeah. So partly it's what decided me to do, yes, it was A-level, it's partly what made me decide to do French at university.
Interesting.
Yeah.
What lesson have you learned in your life that you know is true, but you kind of hate?
Lesson you learn in your life that you know is true, but you kind of hate. I don't hate any of the lessons I've learned. Answer. Tell me something that other people said.
God, now you're asking a good question. God, now I can't remember. You put me on the spot. God, I had an England sevens player.
One of your previous guests listened to this is now going to feel insulted.
Precisely. I literally.
How you edit this bit out?
I sat down with, and he'll love the fact that I've mentioned him on this as well. I sat down with England sevens player Alex Davis recently. Oh God, I can't remember what he said to this, but he said something fascinating, something about I think it was hard work doesn't guarantee success.
Yeah, that's good.
Those lines, yeah.
Okay. Oh, I see what you mean. Okay. You see, when you say that to me, I say, you'll have a better chance of success with hard work.
Okay, but with that in mind, what lesson have you learned in your life that you know is true, but you kind of hate? With that in mind.
Okay, with that in mind.
Make more an Alistair Campbell answer, not Alex.
Okay, I would say, luck has a far bigger role than we imagine. Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. Totally attest to that. Your friend who's having a tough time at the moment,
mm-hmm.
Picks up the phone, rings you, and says he's having a really bad day today. And I'm sure you've mm-hmm. done it in the past. Mm-hmm. What do you say?
Do you want to meet up? And if he says no, if he says yes to meet up, if he says no, I'll just try and probe on what's going on. The fact that he's picked the phone up, unless it's like somebody I talk to all the time, would suggest to me that he's in quite a bad way.
Mm.
So I might gently lead him towards going to see somebody professional.
Interesting.
Mm. I'm a very big, I'm a big purveyor of patients to my psychiatrist.
As am I. My therapist has saved my life on a few occasions now. So yeah, I personally think with therapy, and I'm digressing slightly here, but everybody should see a therapist at some stage.
Or put it another way, everybody should be encouraged to be open, and not just open in terms of talking about what they talk about, but open in terms of who they might talk to and what they might try to get from it.
Mm. When you're struggling with something, struggling yourself, what's your go-to? Who do you turn to? Obviously, Fiona is a big part of that, I imagine, but to improve things.
Yeah, Fiona number one by a mile. David, if it's a psychological thing, David, the psychiatrist.
Hmm.
And I've got a good group of, I've got a really good group of different sorts of friends in different sorts of places.
Hmm.
So yeah, I've got a good little network of that. But if there's only one, it'd be Fiona and the kids.
Hmm. Is that you? Obviously, love running, cycling. Exercise.
Running less so. Running hurts.
Dodgy knee.
Slow body.
Getting old.
I still feel like I'm in my 20s, but when I run, I feel like I'm 63. But cycling, yeah, I do cycling mainly. I'm doing boxing, and so I do exercise every day.
Mm. Okay. You're lying on your deathbed. Looking back at your life, what are you most proud of?
Okay, well, assuming I don't die tomorrow, I hope I'll be able to say that whatever anybody says about me, I can totally change the way the world thinks about my mental health. So I'd be proud of that. I'd be very proud of providing my three kids are carrying on the path that they're on now. I'm very proud of my family. And I would be proud of having worked in politics. And I think for all the shit we got thrown at us, on a fairly regular basis, being part of a political operation that was successful, committed, in it for the right reasons, and did some pretty amazing things to improve the country and other parts of the world. And it's quite a contrast to the fucking shit show we've got today.
Very nice.
I'll also be very proud. I'll be very, very proud if on my deathbed British people sit around saying, do you remember that weird period when we came out of the European Union for a bit? Do you remember that? That was fucking weird, wasn't it? Got back though, didn't we?
We cannot talk about Brexit on this podcast, Alistair.
I just did.
Fucking hell. Yeah. Most proud of as well, Burnley winning the Premier League in.
No, because for a person that I wouldn't have achieved that. I think in terms of your quality, though, that I'm proud of.
But you could still be proud of that, regardless of whether you've achieved it.
Okay, no, but I think you're on your deathbed, what you look back and you're proud of. Yeah, I feel proud that Burnley, but from a personal level, I'd be proud of the fact that I stayed loyal to my football team for the whole of my life, even though we had some very, very, very low points. And I'd be proud of the fact that every single person who listened to your podcast
is going to buy your book
and bought Living Better. Mm. Preferably an independent bookshop, but if they don't have one, then and they want to put more money into Jeff Bezos, you know, overinflated pockets.
Yeah, worst bit is, I'm when it comes out, if you don't send me a signed copy, I'll be buying it on my Kindle. So,
unfortunately. Oh, Kindles are, I think you should get both. You should read it on your Kindle if that's your habit, but have the signed copy pristine just on the shelf.
I've already got a space fit out there. I can see it right now.
Excellent.
When does it come out?
September 3.
Wonderful.
So it's only two weeks.
2 weeks, blimey. Mm. I think we're going on holiday, actually, towards...
When are you going?
Well, we're not sure. We're going to try a staycation, as everyone's doing at the moment. So you're very lucky, actually, to be in France and then Germany.
Well, you say that, but we're trying to work out when I can get back through this meandering route through Deutschland and Belgium. Yeah.
It's pissing down with rain here at the moment, so I don't know. Yeah, absolutely tipping it down.
Where are you?
We're in Putney.
Putney? It's raining in Putney?
It's raining in Putney, yeah. Yeah. Normally it's raining aircraft, but it's currently pissing it down in Putney.
Well, listen, you now have to go to the bedroom.
Yes.
And say to Abby, just wake her up and say, I just want one question for you. How are you feeling today?
I will do that. I think I don't even think she's up yet. Gosh, it's 9 o'clock. She needs to start work soon.
We've done an hour and a half.
We have. I can't thank you enough. And you've got a busy day of cycling ahead. But
yeah. All right, mate.
I appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
Take care. And just email me your address.
I will do.
Okay.
That was an absolutely fascinating hour and a half with Alistair. I can't thank him enough for coming on the podcast this week. It's so interesting diving deep into somebody like his mind to understand really what makes him tick and how he handles manic depression. How he's almost embraced mental illness as part of who he is. And it seemingly made him the person he is today. So, unbelievable. Do let us know what you thought of that episode, either on social media by searching at The Rut Pod, and you can find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, or by leaving us a review. That would be awesome. We really do love to hear your feedback. Next week, I sit down with Netflix's reality TV star, fitness coach and entrepreneur David Birtwistle, who talks to me about bullying, too hot to handle, the pressures of social media and more. See you next week.